Hi. How's it going? Welcome to my show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show. This is Scott Horton Show. Libertarian foreign policy, mostly. Lots and lots of interviews. Although today, just one, I guess. But it's our friend, George Machke, from antipolygraph.org, and we're going to be talking about the trial of Doug Williams. You may have heard it here on the show back a couple weeks ago. I talked to the guy right before he went on a federal trial. He went on a radio show. I don't know if his lawyer told him go ahead or what, but his defense is, I didn't do nothing wrong and I don't have a thing to hide. But they're prosecuting him for an entrapment job where they're claiming that he taught people how to cheat on a polygraph. He has pleaded not guilty, and the trial is on. And George Machke, also, you know, a fellow anti-polygraph activist, is covering the trial. And I don't know, man. This is just kind of a, well, I like George, and, you know, I spoke to him for the first time probably a decade ago or something. Real good guy. And this is just kind of an interesting, funny little thing to me. Do you ever watch Penn & Teller's show, BS, on Showtime there? You can get it on the Pirate Bay. Although I don't recommend watching six seasons straight because you might hang yourself from the ceiling fan. I almost did. I had to quit watching it. I started to just hate human beings so much watching that show. God, it's horrible. But anyway, if you watch the Penn and Teller, I like people, man. That show will force you to be a misanthrope, man. I don't wanna hate them that damn much. But no, you watch their episode on the polygraph, and you'll just be shaking your head. It's one of those "you've got to be kidding me" kind of a things. Like the most corrupt and cynical televangelist or something. It's on that level of corruption. Completely ridiculous. The fact that it even goes by the name lie detector. Like it's magic and knows what the truth is and knows if you're lying or not. Give me a break. Some little box with needles and ink and paper and squiggles and anyway. It's interesting to me what counts as truth to people, you know, sometimes. Oh man. That sucks. All right. Anyway. So, yeah, Machke's going to be on the show today, and we're going to talk about that. And then I got a few other invites out. Maybe I'll be able to get them on. Here's our top headline of the day. Netanyahu wins again. He did say, if you'll remember, he went on the Sunday morning news shows after the framework deal was announced for the nuclear deal with Iran. And he went on NBC, ABC, CNN, and more than that, I think, in one day. And he said, I will do anything that I can, everything that I can to kill this deal. I don't give a damn how bad the President of the United States wants it. I'll do anything I possibly can to undermine this deal. And, well, so apparently he's done it. France says they will oppose the Iran nuclear deal without military site inspections. And now maybe, you know, this is a John Kerry thing and they're working a little dialectic here and trying to haggle a little bit of haggling. But I don't think so. Doesn't this sound like a deal killer to you? Oh, yeah. By the way, we need to be able to show up at your military bases and look around at whatever we want whenever we feel like. You're going to let us do that, right? And meanwhile, what are they searching for? A completely and thoroughly previously debunked story of the nuclear implosion test chamber at Parchin? Really? French Foreign Minister Laurent Fabius said Wednesday that France would oppose a nuclear deal with Iran if it did not allow inspections of military sites. An agreement, quote, will not be accepted by France if it is not clear that verifications can be made at all Iranian facilities, including military sites, Fabius told Parliament. That's from the Agence France-Presse today. You know, I wonder if there's been an Iranian response at all yet. This was just breaking right before the show. Well, this must be previous. Iran envoy, nuclear talks possible beyond the June 30th deadline. I guess, man, if they keep talking, they keep talking. But, yep, there you go. Sabotage, successful sabotage of the Iran nuclear deal. If they can't get it in Congress, they'll get it from the French. Why not? Hey, politics is politics. It's just that the Israelis are better at it than the Americans, unfortunately. And by the way, this is all in the middle of them saying, oh, yeah, well, then, if you are going to do the nuclear deal, then instead of $3 billion in military aid annually, we want $4.5 billion, which it's already somewhere around $4.5 billion as it is if you count all the different loans and guarantees, etc. We want four and a half. We want more. And we want F-35s, which, haha, joke's on you. Those planes are ridiculous, horrible pieces of crap. And so you'd just be destroying your own Air Force by, you know, that. Although, you know, it's all just about making money. So who cares, right? I mean, the F-35, they may be pieces of crap, but you could still kill Gazans with them. Yeah, it's true, they can only carry two bombs, but whatever. So we'll just fly hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of sorties over the prisoners of the Gaza Strip. And yeah, it's not really stealthy, but the Gazans, they don't have radars at all. And yeah, you know, it can't really dogfight, but the Gazans, they don't have any jets. And, can't fly in the rain, but, yeah, it's all right. It's mostly clear and sunny over the Gaza Strip. So, yeah, I guess the F-35 is perfectly suited for fighting civilians in a canned hunt in very expensive ways. So there you go, okay. $4.5 billion a year. Plus F-35s, more F-35s. And then we're going to screw you on the deal anyway. Amazing. All right. Well, now, so it's important to remember that the status quo is the Non-Proliferation Treaty and a current safeguards agreement with the IAEA that's already safeguarding all their nuclear material and verifying its non-diversion to any military purpose, as they always have. Now, if the talks just fall apart based on this French sabotage here, Israeli/French sabotage here, then I don't know that we'll go back to the status quo. We might really have a problem now if this falls apart. Although I think it's pretty transparently the West's fault if it does, but then transparent to who? America's news, you know, TV news hosts? Probably not. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Yeah, I'm kind of annoyed, you know, because I would rather have a nuclear deal with Iran. Just because I'm sick and tired of a Cold War and a threat of a hot war over a civilian nuclear program. And it seemed like, okay, if inspections aren't enough, maybe double extra super special happy lucky wish inspections would be enough so that the war party would have to finally just shut up about it. For God's sake, man. But the Israelis have gotten to the French, who are now saying, nope, that's not good enough. We also need to just be able to walk around your military bases looking at whatever we want to. Yeah, okay. That's not a legitimate request. That's just a poison pill. That's just sabotage. Simple as that. Give me a break. And why? Because, as Benjamin Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel, told his cabinet, our biggest fear is that Iran will honor the deal. As they reported in Haaretz back on April the 12th. And he didn't even say, one day they'll sneak up on you, make a bomb. He just said, his concern is that after 15 years of them not cheating and not breaking the agreement and not having a bunch of sanctions and therefore able to participate in the global economy, etc., that then people will think of them as a normal country. That's it. They will see Iran as a, quote, normal country. And then the next part doesn't say, and then they're going to sneak up on you and nuke you. Just, that's it. That if they obey the nuclear deal for 15 years, then the Cold War against them, between them and the West, Israel by proxy, will just more or less be null and void if it takes that long. That's the threat. And then, you know, multiple cabinet members went out and told this to the newspapers, so, I don't know. If you read the article carefully, I do not think that you'll find any implication that, like, he kind of whispered this to them, that, like, the problem is that peace could break out and then everything would be fine. And that would be horrible, you know, like he's the report from Iron Mountain or something here. He didn't whisper it to him. He just said, like, yeah, I mean, that's what we think, right, guys? Okay, go out and tell the newspapers. Our fear is that they will honor the deal and everything will be fine. There it is. Read it yourself. Read it all the way to the end. It's Barak Ravid, who is, you know, Mr. Mucky Muck at Haaretz, their national security guy. Maybe he's their editor or associate editor or some kind of crap. I forget. I seem to think I remember him having a little bit higher title than just reporter or journalist there. I think he's their editor of some kind or another. Anyway, there it is. From April the 12th, 2015, Netanyahu told cabinet, our biggest fear is that Iran will honor the nuclear deal. So that's why they got to sabotage it. So now, on the other hand, there is a silver lining here, which is I really don't like America fighting directly for and with the Iranians in Iraq. I don't like the Americans doing anything at all. I don't want them fighting for or against the Badr Brigade, for or against the Islamic State, for or against the concerned local citizens. the Saudis, the Iranians, or anyone else. And it's true that the Shiite militias, the what's left of the so-called Iraqi army, basically just their special forces guys, their so-called Golden Brigade, and their Iranian-backed Shiite militias are the only force taking on the Islamic State there at this point. But so let them fight then. That's what they want to do. But America can only make things worse. And in fact, of course, the reason things are this bad is because America's been fighting on the side of the Iranians and their militias and their sock puppets since 2003. Not only did they invade Iraq, but they stayed. And then they spouted all this crap about majority rule. And then the Ayatollah Sistani, the highest ranking Shiite cleric on the planet, Iranian born, living down in Basra in southern Iraq, said, "Hey, if you believe in God, I need you to go outside and demand one man, one vote." So every Shia did. And basically the message was clear to George W. Bush, unless you want to start this war all over again against the people you've been fighting for all this time, you're going to have to go ahead and give in right now. And so he did. So the Badr Corps, basically, the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution, they wrote the new constitution. They won the election of January 2005, hands down. They got to create the new government. And they enlisted the Army, the Marine Corps, the Air Force, all the special forces, the CIA, and the rest, the entire American Empire, as their auxiliary, Quisling sock puppets. Kind of like how Al-Qaeda in Iraq served the Sunni-based insurgency. The Americans served the Badr Corps. Not so much the other way around. And they're the ones who made it this way. They're the ones who, with the surge, took away every last incentive the Shiites could have possibly had to negotiate and reconcile with the Sunni chieftains. They already didn't feel much need. They had America fighting, you know, under the El Salvador option for their policy, you know, from 2003 on, really. Certainly from 2004 on. And all the surge did was make everything that much worse. Give them that much less reason to cooperate with the Sunnis, and they can just hire the Americans to kill the Sunnis for them. Which is what they did. And then you wonder why Maliki, Jafari before him, and then Maliki and his cronies and the government didn't feel any need to negotiate with the Sunnis. What are they going to do about it? They already lost the capital city. They couldn't possibly take it back now. And as Bob Dreyfus explained on this show a decade ago, the Badr Corps, the Supreme Islamic Council, they are so-called federalists. And I mean that in a, you know, like the Eastern Ukrainians are federalists. They wanted virtual, total and complete autonomy for the South, dominance by the South, but then again, only of the South. They wanted an end to minority Sunni rule, and they wanted the capital city. They never had the ambition to rule Fallujah, to rule the Anbar province, to rule Mosul. It's alien territory. It's a foreign country to them. They've made it this way. So that's the silver lining to the breakdown of the nuclear talks, if that is indeed what we're seeing here, is maybe an end to America's alliance with Iran and Iraq. That's what I was trying to get at, wasn't it? Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. You can buy transcripts of these interviews now. Let's go to scotthorton.org/transcripts. They're reasonably priced, man. I guess. I think. You know, I don't know. We'll see what happens with that. Stop by the chat room, scotthorton.org/chat. Hang out with the guys in there. Hey, guys. Like I say, George Matschke's coming up to talk about the Doug Williams trial. Yeah. So, listen, I got important stuff to talk about. Lots of different stuff, but I want to get back to, the war with the Islamic State now. Just in case you missed it. Look at Justin's article today. Wish he'd come up with a little bit better title than that, but... Raimondo's got a great article at antiwar.com today about the rise of the Islamic State, what they knew and when they knew it. For those of you who are regular listeners to this show, depending on how many years back, I guess, you know that ever since the dawn of the Arab Spring, I've been doing my best to cover the American-Saudi counter-revolution, and that means hijacking the Arab Spring in Libya and in Syria while stomping it down in Bahrain, and I guess they ended up conceding to it, you could say, in Egypt and in Yemen. They did everything they could to keep Saleh there for a little while before they finally pushed him out. But anyway, you know, the most important part of this has been taking the side of the enemy in Libya and in Syria. And I'm sorry to frame it all in terms of I told you so and all of that kind of thing, but the point of it being I told you so is that obviously I'm just some guy out here, right? I'm Norm MacDonald, man. I'm just some guy saying a thing. And yet, throughout the whole Libya war, go back and check the archives from 2011, all of the coverage of the Libya war, we're talking with the best of them, Patrick Coburn and the rest, about how these are veterans of the Iraq war. These are Al-Qaeda in Iraq, guys. Any Libyan who went to fight with Zarqawi and the Sunni-based insurgency against the Americans and the Badr Brigade back in Iraq War II were considered Al-Qaeda in Iraq. They were the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group and Ansar al-Sharia. And I'm sorry, I forget the name of the town now, but it's this town further east than Benghazi in Libya, which is where, you know, the vast majority of the Al-Qaeda volunteers came from to go and fight in Iraq War II. And then when they went home, America outright took their side against Gaddafi, which actually has precedent because the British had tried to work with the guys who had come home from Afghanistan, the founding fathers, you could say, of the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group against Gaddafi back in the late 1990s. It was all in The Guardian. But that didn't work then. But now Bush brought Gaddafi back in from the cold in 2003. I saw something earlier that said, yeah, if we hadn't killed Saddam and done that war, then Gaddafi would still have his weapons of mass destruction. Oh, give me a break. He bought a bunch of rusted old crap from AQ Khan's garage sale just so he could give it up. He never even put a single centrifuge together. Didn't have the money or the scientific establishment to even make it possible in a million years. It was simply a playing card. And he'd been begging to come in from the cold since at least 1996. And I know that because former senator and presidential candidate Gary Hart wrote a thing in the New York Times Magazine back in, say, oh, I don't know, 2006 or so, maybe. Saying, oh, yeah, I was in Athens, Greece. And one of Gaddafi's henchmen came up to me and basically got down on his knees, crying, begging, please, can we be friends again, Uncle Sam? What can we do to work things out from the bad old days? As early as 96, And the only reason that Bush made a deal with him instead of Cold War against Gaddafi is because he needed something in the news to try to spin it like the Iraq war was good for something. We can't come up with a single positive result in Iraq, but let's pretend that the Iraq war scared Gaddafi into giving up his crates of boxed old junk that he bought from AQ Khan. That the CIA was basically, you know, for intents and purposes, in on it with AQ Khan from the beginning. They knew that he stole that stuff when he was stealing it from Yurenko in the 70s, and they let him walk with it in the freaking first place. We're monitoring his entire network all along. Had undercover informants inside of it. And anyway, sorry I'm off on a little tangent there, but the point being that they made friends with Gaddafi. They brought him in from the cold as a PR stunt to try to bolster the Iraq war, as I say there. And then, but America stabbed him in the back anyway when the Arab Spring came. And it's been obvious since then. And very early reports, I think the very first report that I know of was Pepe Escobar saying that, you know, he had from his sources in Libya that there were men, jihadists, and guns being put on ships and sent off to Syria. And that would have been in the spring of 2011. Then somebody or other wrote a thing in The Guardian saying, yeah, Prince Bandar, was it in The Guardian? It might have been in The Economist or something. Anyway, first word of Prince Bandar getting to work on the Syria angle of the Arab Spring was in the spring of 2011, from the very get-go. And then I was filling Raimondo's article full of links last night, and I was reminded, I totally forgot about this, man. And I used to say this all the time, but for some reason it dropped out of my mind. Phil Giraldi had an article called NATO versus Syria at the American Conservative Magazine, and he had another one at antiwar.com at the same time called Washington's Secret Wars. And both of those say that he had it from CIA sources, because he's a former CIA officer and he gets to say stuff like that, that Barack Obama had signed two new findings for covert action, one for Syria and one for Iran. And they are getting to work arming these guys up. So we knew that Obama had signed a new finding for covert action to support these guys, who we already knew were jihadists, in Syria before New Year's 2012. All along. I mean, we already knew that they were jihadists, and I guess there were already reports. I don't remember every last report from 2011. Eric Margolies had a report. Our friend Eric Margolies came back from France and said, I was talking to guys in the military and the intelligence services in France, and they've got special forces and spies on the ground helping to organize the rebellion in Syria right now. That was in the summer of 2011. Blam. And then the Sunday Times in England had this story about the ship landing in Turkey where the Muslim Brotherhood and other jihadists were fighting over who was going to get the guns. But it was chock full of weapons. And then this has been one angle mostly not pursued by the right, because they're implicated in this, kind of. So they sort of gloss it over, although Fox News on their, you know, their own jihad on the Benghazi scandal have brought up the idea that, and I don't know if they really proved it, but they have, I think they posed it as the form of a question, but they had plenty of evidence that, yes, of course, this is what was going on, was the consulate there was more or less cover for a CIA operation for running Gaddafi's guns to Syria. Let's try to take the shoulder-fired missiles off the market, but let's send everything else off to bin Laden's legions. You know? And this is right after he was killed, right? As soon as bin Laden was dead, they're like, and then they're going, oh yeah, we totally and completely finished winning the war on terrorism because we finally hunted down and killed that one guy, right at the same time that they're breathing new life into this movement that could have never existed. You know, there's another article I linked to in Justin's article today, and I interviewed the lady, and I botched the interview because we got off on a stupid, poorly phrased, you know, tangents and whatever. And I apologize to her to this day for that interview. And I doubly apologize because I can't remember her name. But it doesn't matter. It's in the Politico magazine, and it's called The Jihad Next Door. And it's all about how Al-Qaeda in Iraq saw opportunity in the Arab Spring in Syria and took it. And it's sort of between the lines. It's not the coverage of her article. She's just telling that story. Hey. Oh, man, I didn't even hear the bumper music going. Eh. Anyway, it's between the lines that, yeah, this is all in the space that the West has created for them. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. Hey, man. I do go on too long, I know. And then I couldn't hear the damn bumper music, so I got all cut off in the middle. I was saying that article about in the Politico magazine. I don't know who's their editor, but they got really good journalism in Politico magazine, man. I'm telling you that. Anyway, this lady, whose name I can't remember, she wrote this thing, and it was all about how Al-Qaeda in Iraq came back to life because of the war in Syria. And she doesn't really address the Western role whatsoever in there. You just have to know that from other sources and what have you and all that. But when you read her article, you can see how this is all in the space that the West was helping to create. From the very beginning, they insisted Assad had to go and that the rebels should not negotiate, or whatever opposition there should not negotiate. And you know, the war party's idea, their talking point anyway, is that, yeah, if only we had completely just run right in there and given a ton of arms and money to the moderates, then the jihadists would have never had their foothold. Where that's not true. It would have just been even more money and guns ending up in the hands of the jihadists. The only thing that the Americans could have done to prevent that would have been, well, it wouldn't have prevented it. It would have just created it in a different way, would be occupy the whole damn place. But we saw how, even with 150,000 troops in Iraq, very quickly they were not the most important decision-making force in that country, politically speaking. So, those things don't always quickly equate. So, all that is a hoax. And anyway, so just like the point being that apparently the guys over at the DIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, they're concerned too, or at least they're interested in pointing out the contradictions here. And there are, you know, big redacted portions of this article, but I think it is fair to say, and you could quibble about, you know, what is redacted, the exact context of every statement here, but it's still the unavoidable conclusion that they say, look, the opposition to the Syrian government is us, the West. And the support for the Syrian government is Russia and Iran and Hezbollah. These are the sides. It says the West, Gulf countries, and Turkey support the opposition, while Russia, China, and Iran support the regime. So those are the sides. And on the outside, and on the inside, the Salafists, the Muslim Brotherhood, and Al-Qaeda in Iraq are the major forces driving the insurgency. And that was in 2012, in August of 2012. In fact, right around then, I believe the Obama government officially announced that the al-Nusra Front is Al-Qaeda in Iraq. And then, so in 2013, they split. And the Islamic State broke off from al-Nusra, and al-Nusra basically is the Syrian veterans of al-Qaeda in Iraq, whereas ISIS is more Iraqi veterans of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, certainly in the leadership roles. So that's a lot of what they split about, but also in terms of tactics, where the Al-Qaeda idea was to keep fighting and not try to declare a caliphate yet, and whereas Baghdadi and his guys and his Ba'athist allies wanted to go ahead and declare a state. At this point, I think Nusra are just the useful idiots of ISIS, right? They take the ground and then ISIS occupies it and owns it. But anyway, who all is whose useful idiot is a fun game to play when you're talking about all this stuff. Of course, the Western countries and their allies have more power. But again, that doesn't necessarily mean that they're really the ones in charge of what's going on. And so anyway, sorry, back to the mathematical proof here. The opposition is Al-Qaeda. The supporters of the opposition are us. And they want to declare an Islamic state in Syria. And we think that if they do, that it might completely destabilize Iraq and break off half of Iraq. And that these guys will come right back into power and take control in Mosul and Ramadi. The two biggest victories of the Islamic State a year apart there. Almost a year apart. They just finally finished taking Ramadi. They'd owned half of Ramadi for a while now, I guess. Owned, to put it, you know, as a figure of speech there. They'd taken half of Ramadi a while back, but finished taking it. Mosul, of course, fell last June, and then Baghdadi got up there on the balcony and gave a speech and declared himself the caliph and all of that. Just as predicted in this DIA document from 2012. Just as we talked about on this show. And I know I was annoying you guys and driving you crazy, you know, the whole first part of 2014. And really before that, the end of 2013 too. Well, this whole time, but I know I was like annoying my friends about it. Man, this ISIS thing is a big deal. Nobody's even paying attention to us, except Patrick Coburn is telling us that this thing is getting way the hell out of hand here. As he put it, the American and Western support for the rebellion in Syria is re-energizing the Sunni insurgency in Iraq. And every time he goes to Baghdad, the Shiite leadership say, man, oh man, are we under pressure because of what America and our friends are doing in the country next door. It's crazy. We wish they would stop. And then he was also reporting that Shia Iraqi army types stationed out at Mosul withdrew. When did he report that? In 2013. A year before the fall of Mosul, he said that, hey, they were under pressure and they were feeling way stranded way out there on the frontier. He wrote that. I interviewed him about it. So, anyway, don't let them say, I didn't tell you so, and don't let them say they didn't tell themselves so. And, in fact, of course, I got to bring up again the great quote of Hillary Clinton that I often like to play, that you hear at the intro to the show, actually, where she says, well, geez, Al-Qaeda and Hamas are supporting the rebellion in Syria. Are we supporting Al-Qaeda? Are we supporting Hamas? Right? I'm paraphrasing slightly, but that's about it. And then the great Ben Swan got a chance to interview Barack Obama. And I'm sorry, I should have included the question in these clips, but I guess I was just trying to keep them short at the time. But here's Barack Obama's crappy answer to Ben Swan saying, hey man, so you're backing the rebels, but the rebels are Al-Qaeda. So explain that to me, Mr. President, dude. And this is in the spring, I believe March, possibly April of 2012.
I share that concern. And so what we've done is to say we will provide non-lethal assistance to Syrian opposition leadership that are committed to a political transition, committed to an observance of human rights. We're not going to just dive in and get involved with a civil war that, in fact, involves some elements of people who are genuinely trying to get a better life, but also involve some folks who would, over the long term, do the United States harm.
You got to admit, he's almost Bill Clintonian in his you know, pretended plausible deniability and all that kind of thing. Oh, yeah, no, we're picking and choosing very carefully, and we're only giving a little bit of non-lethal aid. And No, it's just the Saudis, the Qataris, the Kuwaitis, the Turks giving, you know, tons, pallets full of dollars to these guys, paying all their salaries and giving them weapons. Many, many weapons. And so, you know, I asked Flint Leverett at back probably 2012, maybe at least 2013. Hey, Flint Leverett, I'm sorry. I know I'm kind of a kook. I don't even have a degree. I don't know what's going on here. I'm just trying to paraphrase and not be too hyperbolic. But doesn't it seem like it's just supposed to be plausible deniability? But really, it's not very plausible deniability when we just have the Saudis arming Al-Qaeda in Syria for us instead of, you know, just like we had the Israelis arm Iran for us in the 1980s under Ronald Reagan when he needed to sell some missiles to Iran. Oh, we'll just have the Israelis do it. Well, still, it was Ronald Reagan that did it. Did anybody miss that? Did Israel get the blame? Oh, no, it was just the Israelis were selling the missiles. No, it wasn't. They were doing it for us. Everybody knows that it was the Americans that bore the responsibility for that. Isn't this the same thing as that? And Flint Leverett, former National Security Council guy under George W. Bush, and I guess Clinton before him, said, yeah, it is. You're right. What can I say? Go back and check the archives. He said, yeah, that's what it is. It's not very plausible deniability. America has a deliberate policy of backing this rebellion, so-called jihadi rebellion in Syria with their allies, as insane and as treasonous as it is. You know, he didn't use that word, but as crazy as it is on its face. So, and here's the DIA. It's really important. I think you should look at it. Check out Justin's article today on it. You can find the link to the DIA report. And later on in the show, we're going to talk about the war now and what's next. In America today, teachers, cops, judges, and other so-called public servants make far more than the average taxpayer. And their pensions? Well, if the people knew, they'd join us. That's where you come in. Taxpayers United of America is embarking on a great new project to train activists how to take on the parasites in your communities. The entire process, from prying loose the facts to disseminating the truth to the people. The next one is June 13th in Denver. It's just $5 if you sign up now at taxpayersunited.org/govpensions.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more war in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. All right, we're going to get back to the war, including this great new article about Israeli support for al-Nusra in Syria and more along those lines here in a minute. But I'm happy to change the subject for a minute, to tell you the truth. On the line is, I didn't hit the button yet. I'm just going to pretend he's already answered. On the line is George Matschke. He is the founder of the website antipolygraph.org, and he is covering the trial of Doug Williams, United States versus Doug Williams. And, I'm only just seeing the update here, day two. I don't want to spoil it, but what a terrible headline. Welcome back to the show. George, how are you doing?
I'm fine, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing good. You know, I read part one, and then I'm only now realizing that there's a part two here, and so go ahead and break the bad news.
Yes, on the second day of the trial, Doug Williams changed his plea to guilty.
And why? And, was he guilty?
He acknowledged that he was guilty before the judge. In doing so, he didn't state the reasons for changing his plea. And he hasn't spoken about that. However, a lawyer with whom
I lost you. You cut out there for a second. He hasn't spoken about?
About his reasons for changing his plea. Hmm. In fact, he hasn't made any public statements since that day.
Now, how much time is he facing?
The maximum for the crimes to which he pled guilty is 20 years imprisonment for each of the five counts, a fine of I think it's $200,000 or $250,000 per count. So it's more than $1 million in fines and up to 100 years in prison. Jeez. Is the maximum. However, under federal sentencing guidelines, any maximum punishment should be considerably less than that.
Well, now, his crime, if I understand it right, was just that they successfully entrapped him into teaching some undercover federal agents how to beat a polygraph. Is that right?
That's right. The only crimes for which he was charged were those that the government managed and planned.
Oh, man. George, we're having a problem however, with bandwidth there. Could you just rewind that whole statement for us?
Yes. The only crimes with which Williams was charged were the ones that were planned by undercover agents. Mm.
And now, so is there some kind of line there between explaining to someone, this is how to make yourself not appear to be lying on a lie detector in a way that's a matter of free speech versus a way that really is criminally conspiring to break a law?
Yes, I could, from the testimony that was delivered in the trial, it became clear what one would have to do to avoid such an entrapment in the future. For example, if anyone wanted to provide this as a service, a training in how to pass polygraphs, the key would be not to train anyone who tells you that their purpose in getting the training is to lie to any government official.
But so
whether it be in a job application or a
is that the law, or that's just where the judges have drawn the line, or how's that work?
Well, no line was drawn by the judge here in that there was a guilty plea.
Like in earlier cases, or I guess really just the first part of the question, is that the law according to Congress or according to state legislatures?
Well, I think in all fairness, if you read the indictment, one could conceive of how the actions with which Williams was charged could be construed as violating the mail fraud laws and the witness tampering statute, because they're very broadly written. Mm-hmm. So I can see a case could be made that this was a violation of the law. But I'm not aware of any analogous cases to the case of Doug Williams or Chad Dixon, who's the other person who was targeted in this criminal investigation. He was a man in Indiana who taught people how to pass the polygraph as well.
Right. Well, we can get to that in a second, but and let me get to mail fraud, back to mail fraud in a second. But as far as the witness tampering, I can see that there's some kind of qualitative difference between someone saying, I'm afraid that I will be falsely indicated as dishonest, and so I want to protect myself from that, versus someone coming and saying, I'm going to lie and I want to get away with lying. However, I'm not so sure I see the legal difference there as far as the responsibility of the person doing the teaching. How in the hell is that witness tampering? I mean, witness tampering, we know what witness tampering is, and it's an entirely different thing, right?
Well, yeah. Normally, when we think of witness tampering as laypersons, we'd think of something like intimidating a witness not to testify at a trial.
Or trying to bribe them or influence them somehow. Yeah, appeal to their right. Religious faith, something.
Right. But in this case, the government's argument was that he attempted to, and it's in the language of the statute, to corruptly influence a potential witness, not even necessarily someone who had testified or was necessarily going to. So it's a quite broadly written statute.
Yeah, sounds like it. And I guess it sounds like his lawyer told him, give it up, man. Throw yourself on the mercy of the court here because they're going to nail you anyway.
That's quite possible. I don't know, again, for sure, but one plausible rationale that was a knowledgeable person who observed the trial was that if it seems likely that one is going to be convicted, one might change one's plea to guilty in hope of receiving a lesser sentence under the federal sentencing guidelines.
Mm. Well, so what's the mail fraud part of this?
That has to do with having received payment through the U.S. Postal Service. That's all.
Yeah, see, that's the one where they can just nail anybody with anything, right?
Right. You would think that mail fraud is offering a service or something for sale through the mail and then taking the money but not delivering it. But it's much more broad than that.
Right. Yeah, I mean, fraud, again, just like witness tampering, we know what fraud is. It's not receiving a check unless it's, you know, has that component to it that it was deceit that tricked the person into sending the check, right? And that they were complaining. But we don't have that situation here at all, do we?
Well, the argument, again, by the prosecutors is this, that Williams' training was a fraudulent service and he received payment for it through the U.S. Postal Service, so that violates the mail fraud statute.
The training is fraudulent itself. Well, in what way?
In that it was not that it didn't work. In fact, the government's key witness in the case all but acknowledged that the training does work. Training someone, for example, to get away with lying during a examination. One point that was asked instructed the persons receiving the training to deny having received it to investigators. And
we have real bandwidth problems here, George, so I don't know if you're on Wi-Fi and pacing around the house or exactly what, but we're going to have to figure that out during the break here and get it straight.
Okay.
But hey, it's a good time to take a break. So hold it right there, and we'll be right back, everybody, with George Matschke from antipolygraph.com with the sad news. Doug Williams has pleaded guilty in his federal trial for teaching some trappers how to beat a polygraph. Hey. So, do you have any idea why your internet's cutting out on us?
Yeah, I'm moving closer to the router, although I had done tests and everything was working quite well.
Okay, well,
I'm right next to my router now.
Okay, that's cool. If you have an Ethernet, maybe go ahead and plug into it.
Yeah, unfortunately. Don't it's quite
I mean you're still cutting out on me right now, in fact.
Shall we disconnect and get a new connection?
Yeah, that's a good idea. Maybe it's just a bad Skype connection. I'll call you right back.
Okay.
This part of the Scott Horton Show is sponsored by Audible.com. And right now, if you go to audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show, you can get your first audiobook for free. Of course, I'm recommending Michael Swanson's book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. Maybe you've already bought The War State in paperback, but you just can't find the time to read it. Well, now you can listen while you're out marching around. Get the free audiobook of The War State by Michael Swanson, produced by Listen and Think Audio, at audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show here. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. I'm on the line with George Matschke. We got the plain old telephone service happening now. So that should be good. That way he can hear me and I can hear him. And you guys can hear us both. All right. So now, I think where we were, George, we were talking about the bogus mail fraud charge. And I guess I've heard this before as referred to as the thing that they can make stick to anyone. If the feds want to put someone in prison, if you basically checked your mailbox, they can somehow make that a federal offense. For receiving junk mail or whatever it is they want to frame you up on. And it sounds like that's what they did here. You're telling me they're not saying that he was you know, selling some bogus potion or whatever, some kind of snake oil that did not work, that was not the fraud. But so what was right. the fraud?
So the fraud was assisting people who intended to lie in the course of a federal investigation.
So conspiracy to commit fraud by way of the mail somehow? Something?
Well, none of the charges are actual conspiracy, but actual witness. There are 3 counts of witness tampering and 2 counts of mail fraud in the indictment.
And then in the cases of the mail fraud, it's the feds sending him his check?
Yes, payment sent through the U.S. mail.
Okay. But by the ones who entrapped him, not just, you know, somebody else in his...
That's right. An interesting and I think important point in understanding this case is that the feds really wanted Doug Williams' business records, which they got. Or for at least something on the for nearly 5,000 of his customers, not necessarily people who had received in-person training, but people who just bought his manual online, either through his website. Now it's available for sale on Amazon.com. So they got a list of close to 5,000 customers and actually went and interviewed many of them, seeking any evidence that Williams had committed any crime. And yet, none of the crimes for which he was charged involved any actual customers.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, well, I was just going to say, as Marissa Taylor of McClatchy, D.C. has reported, yeah. Based on this list, the government created a watch list and circulated it to some 17 government agencies that have polygraph programs. So now, when anyone goes for a federal polygraph, they can check their name against the list of Doug Williams' customers.
Oh, I see, yeah. I was just going to ask you about the McClatchy stories. I had forgotten about that detail, but then that's part of kind of a series that they did on the whole new clampdown inside the executive branch, and not just in the national security departments, right, but all across
right. The lead agency for what was called Operation Lie Busters that targeted people who provided training in how to pass a polygraph, that was the United States Customs and Border Protection. That was the lead agency.
And they're even making it where, for the national security employees, they cannot discuss with journalists anything, even if it's not classified at all. And then for everybody else who's not even in national security, where it's not even a matter of classification, they're all being ordered that no one may speak to the media. Everything must go through the official channels and official spokesman under penalty of I don't know what besides firing. Is it as far as prosecution, this whole new regime of – and they're trying to get everybody to tattletale on the guy in the cubicle next to him and all of this stuff, right?
Yes. People are being discouraged from talking to the press without authorization, even about unclassified matters. And one of the areas about which people who are subject to polygraph screening may be questioned is any contact that they've had with the media.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like... from what I was reading, it was like a whole new order inside the departments about who's allowed to speak to who and when and why and all of that. You know, a real change, and people were kind of befuddled by it.
Right. Well, I know in the intelligence community, I'm a former Army Reserve intelligence officer and interrogator. We were always discouraged from talking with the media at all, and it was... something, you know, we'd never do. It certainly wasn't authorized, and we knew it was something you could, you know, lose a security clearance for. So I'm not sure how much change there really is in that respect. The thing about talking about unclassified matters seems new for it to be codified in writing in a directive from the Director of National Intelligence, mm-hmm. as it has been. But, you know, back to the conviction of... of Doug Williams and Chad Dixon for teaching people how to pass polygraph tests. I think an important thing to note here is that the government, by prosecuting them, by criminally investigating them, has all but acknowledged that the polygraph tests can be beaten. Mm-hmm. And I think the for purposes of national security and public safety, perhaps rather than, you know, prosecuting people who are telling the truth about lie detectors, that they don't work, that they can be beaten, and they're easy to beat, here's how to do it, our government should reassess its reliance on polygraphs. Right. We have a recommendation from the National Research Council that polygraph screening not be used, that it's, you know, in it's not sufficiently reliable to be used for national security purposes.
Yeah, you know what it is? It's like the Iraqis standing around with a got the little pretended gizmo on a stick. It doesn't even have a battery in it. It doesn't do anything. But they just go, well, it's a bomb detector, and they rely on it.
51, the fake bomb detector.
Yeah,
that I think was sold for $60,000 or pounds a pop. It's quite outrageous. And actually, the lie detector works on very much the same principle, in that it can't really detect lies, but it does have some usefulness if the person who's being tested believes that it can detect deception. Maybe they'll make admissions, but it's often wrong. And so numerous spies have beaten the polygraph using simple countermeasures, such as Doug Williams was teaching, mm-hmm. such as you can still find on the internet. You know, putting Doug Williams in prison isn't going to destroy the knowledge of how to pass the polygraph. If anything, to the extent that it's brought public attention to it, more people have learned that the polygraph is unreliable and it's easy to beat.
Yeah, well, he said on this show, I'm sure you heard the interview, where Williams said, hey, listen, I was a con artist for years, not teaching people how to beat it, but being a polygraph so-called expert himself. That he said all he was a hustler. His job wasn't detecting lies. His job was scaring you and tricking you into believing that he could detect your lies. That was it. It was a prop in his little scam, like he was a barker at a carnival. Nothing to do with anything scientific. It's not even expertise any more than it's expertise running
the expertise is expertise in reading people. It's rather like cold reading, like a psychic or fortune teller might use in reading another person and exploiting their fears as a leg up in an interrogation. And sometimes it works, for example, in criminal investigations where, you know, a dumb criminal can be convinced to confess. And hopefully it's a valid confession and corroborating evidence can be found. But sometimes even false confessions have been coerced from people because the police believe that they've gotten a liar and they just won't accept any innocent explanation. And, of course, for screening purposes, for employees, I think it's just wrong on several counts. Again, first, from a national security standpoint, because it's unreliable and easily beaten, and numerous spies, including Ana Belén Montes, who was the Defense Intelligence Agency's top analyst for Cuban affairs, she beat the polygraph. Going into it, she was a Cuban agent before she even applied for work with the DIA. They taught her how to pass it. So, and it worked brilliantly for her. And again, recent documents that were leaked to antipolygraph.org that we've published from DIA, from Customs and Border Protection, show that the only people they're catching trying to beat the polygraph are those who use the most crude, uneducated techniques that anyone who knew what they were doing wouldn't do. People who are sophisticated, who have, for example, read Doug Williams' manual, who have read The Lie Behind the Lie Detector, which is our book available for free on antipolygraph.org, they would know how to use techniques that the government cannot detect and that are proven effective.
Yeah. Hey, let me ask you one thing real quick, and we're over time here, but I want to ask you real quick. Has anybody ever taken some polygraph readouts, the paperwork, and given them to a bunch of different polygraph experts and see if you could even get them to agree on what they all say, like in a blind test?
Yeah, that would be like a test of inter-rater reliability. And it's, I think, close to like 70% to 80% of agreement between polygraph examiners on sets of charts.
That sounds like a fail to me. 70, that's a D minus.
Well, that's would provide an upper limit for validity if it had any, which it doesn't. But and then there's other things like test, retest reliability, which the federal government doesn't want to look into that because they know the results wouldn't be good for them. So, it's unscientific nonsense, and it's not surprising that the techniques used by the federal government and state and local governments for polygraph screening and testing were not developed by scientists but by interrogators who perhaps were well-meaning but who, you know, lacked an understanding of the scientific method, didn't do double-blind studies, didn't have an understanding of proper control procedures for a scientific test. So what we have is a pseudoscience that has, in a sense, become the official pseudoscience of the United States government. The Iraqis had the ADE-651 fake bomb detector. Well, we have a fake lie detector that we're using for the most sensitive things. In Cy Hirsch's reporting recently, that walk-in who came to, I think it was the U.S. Embassy in Pakistan, what was the first thing they did? They sent someone to Pakistan to give them a polygraph test, which is just absurd that the decision whether to have confidence in such an informant would be made.
Throw him in the river to see if he's a witch, you know? If he sinks and drowns, that means he was a good Christian and died a good Christian death and went to heaven anyway, so it's all right. But if he floats and gets away, well, then that means he's guilty.
So I think it's deeply disturbing that important questions affecting national security are allowed to be influenced on such junk science. And it's really well past time that we abandoned our misplaced reliance on junk science. And like other countries like the UK, like Germany, realize that there is no magic lie detector and we're better off not kidding ourselves. We're better off taking a realistic approach to deception, knowing that, you know, this lie test doesn't work. It might be useful for admissions from time to time, but there's adverse consequences that come from relying on something that doesn't work. And it also depends on, requires the government to misinform the public about it, to create a false public belief in the lie detector to keep the whole musical chair games going.
Right. All right, y'all. That is George Matschke. He's at Anti-Polygraph. Can't talk very good today.
.org.
Antipolygraph.org, and the book is The Lie Behind the Lie Detector. The whole thing is there free, and I'm pretty sure, at least it used to be, that people could find the Penn and Teller episode on the lie detector that features George on YouTube, at least parts of it anyway. So you should be able to find that, and you could definitely find it on the Pirate Bay if you want to go sifting around figuring out which episode it is. But anyway, so thanks for coming back on the show, George, and covering this sad news for us about Doug Williams' guilty plea. And I'll be looking forward to your sad update about just what they're going to do to him.
I'll keep you posted.
For his honest work, exposing their dishonesty. So thanks again for your time, George. Appreciate it.
Okay. Thanks, Scott. Bye-bye.
All right, y'all. And I'm really bad at obeying the hard breaks on this show, as you could tell. So we went all the way through the break there. But anyway, so that was George Matschke. Yeah, the polygraph. Can you believe that's even a thing? That was really what you missed there right at the end. He was really talking about it. It's witchcraft. It's completely stupid. The polygraph is completely ridiculous. The fact that you have to believe in it is proof that you have to believe in it because it ain't a real thing. You can't know about it. You can only believe in it or not. What the hell is that? That proves right there. Well, do you believe that these things are effective? Or da, da, da? You believe that this particular administrator of a polygraph knows what to do and say? It almost makes me want to take a course in being an administrator just so I could make fun of it more and better. Well, you see, if this squiggly line gets up to a 3 and that squiggly line gets up to a 4 at the same time, well, then that's how you know, right? It can't be much more complicated than that. These kooks, these goofballs that come at a dime a dozen, hawking their crap. How many bogus polygraph experts do you think we have in this country? 10,000? And the skill that it requires is comparable to what, do you think? A doctor? Maybe. If you're really cynical about doctors, probably more like his receptionist. Yeah. Or her receptionist. I didn't mean to be sexist about doctors' genders. Lord knows there are lady doctors, plenty of them. Anyway. So, yeah, there you go. All right, now back to the Islamic State. So, like I say, DIA thing, Judicial Watch, simple FOIA. I wonder if someone in the DIA really wanted this to get out, or what's the politics behind this release here? Simple FOIA, not even a leak. Simple FOIA, DIA, sounding like this show, predicting the rise of the Islamic State due to American and allied policy. August 2012. Read Raimondo about it, his article today is about it. Find the document for yourself and read it. Anyway, so here's some more news along these lines, and I'll figure out which one I really want to go back to. Hezbollah says it will step up presence in Syria as needed. Why is the media ignoring Israel's alliance with Al-Qaeda? This guy I'm going to interview, I hope, tomorrow. Pentagon dramatically underreports civilian deaths in Syria strikes. That one's at news.antiwar.com. Officials trying to blame mythical, quote, restraint for failing war. Yeah, just send out the B-52s to carpet bomb them like Nixon did to North Vietnam. Oh, and LBJ before him. Yeah, that'll do the trick. Right? Like in North Vietnam. Oh, wait, no, it didn't do the trick then. Anyway. Now get this, check it out. The Shiite militias actually showed up in Ramadi, is that right? Shiite militia battle for Ramadi, 223 killed across Iraq. That's Margaret Griffiths at news, nope, at original.antiwar.com/updates. Original.antiwar.com/updates. Margaret Griffiths keeping track of all the Iraqi casualties for us here. Holy 2007, man. I'll tell you what over there right now. God dang. Iraq army held 10-1 advantage during Ramadi defeat, sources say. That one is in Al Jazeera. But now they're back? I'm confused about that. Why did the Maliki government have so little? I mean, oh, might as well be the Maliki government, sorry. The Abadi government. Why did they not try at all to hold on to the half of Ramadi that they had been holding on to for a while? You know, David Enders had that article, that video report for Vice, where he's saying, yeah, you know, half the city is still under the control of the politicians set up under the Bush regime. Still, you know, ostensibly tied to Baghdad and loyal to him. I don't think he was asking everybody's, for everybody's mosque membership card or whatever, but they were saying, boy, we sure could use some help here. And that was, a few weeks back, 3 or 4 weeks ago. And of course, they were calling for American help, but never mind that. Just what about the Baghdad government? Now they want to go and send their militias up against the Islamic State that has now taken the whole city. I guess it must be internal politics. As far as they're concerned. Interesting to see here how this is unfolding. And then, let's see, ISIS fighters complaining of Saudi nepotism on groups' waiting list for suicide bombers. I'm going to have to get back to that one. I didn't read that one yet. America blaming not just their mythical restraint in Syria, but also blaming Iraqi forces for not doing enough in the war. But then, and I think this is where I want to land here, assuming I got the whole article. Oh, good, I do. The Wall Street Journal, and this is from, what's the date on this damn thing, guys? The 24th. Defense Secretary opens possibility to strategy. Jesus, I can't talk today. I should have taken today off, dude. Sound like George W. Bush up here trying to talk. Strategery. We're going to work on our strategery here, and we might shift it. He said. Ash Carter gives withering... Is it Ash now? We're all calling him by his nickname, Wall Street Journal. Ash Carter gives withering critique of Iraqi defense forces over Islamic State's capture of Ramadi. Defense Secretary Ashton Carter held open the possibility of a strategy shift by the White House on Iraq a few days after recent setbacks in Iraq and Syria revived sharp criticism of the Obama administration's approach in combating extremist groups there. Islamic State forces last week captured the key Iraqi city of Ramadi and Hang on, I'm trying to find the... Here it is. Among the calls, more aggressively arming Sunni tribes and Peshmerga forces who oppose the Islamic State. There comes a time when we have to change the kinds of support we will give. We'll make that recommendation. So, that's it. All he's saying is, maybe instead of arming the Iraqi government, the Baghdad, Shiistan government only, maybe we should directly arm the Kurds and try to find enough Sunni tribal guys to go ahead and directly arm them to fight against the Islamic State. If there's a strategy that makes sense here at all at this point, it would be only the latter part. Not that I'm recommending anything but opposition to the entire existence of the U.S. government and its every activity. It should not exist, anywhere near the Middle East, to say the least. But I'm saying as far as what makes sense at all, does not make sense to back the Bata Brigade in the hopes that someday you can get them to invade Fallujah for you. If you could ever build up the Iraqi Shia army to be powerful enough to rouse the Islamic State out of Fallujah and Ramadi and Mosul, then what are you going to have other than millions and millions of Iraqi Sunni who all have to come together under the Islamic State to push it back? Or I guess they could all just go out to the desert and die of thirst. But assuming they're to live at all, you would be taking every Sunni Iraqi in Sunnistan who hates the Islamic State and driving them right into their arms. That's what's already been going on. And then, of course, the Sunni refugees who hate and fear the Islamic State and are trying to get away, they go to Baghdad. They're not welcome there because George Bush and Donald Rumsfeld and the Ayatollah Khamenei fought a giant war there to give that entire city to the Shiites now. So they're suspect. Every Sunni refugee coming to Baghdad is considered a possible ISIS suicide bomber infiltrator type and are, you know, desperate, living inside the mosque wall and terrified to go outside. And, anyway. If any of this would make sense, it would be arm up local Sunnis against them in the way that Petraeus did during the awakening. The awakening, which means the Sunni Iraqis were already turning on Al-Qaeda in Iraq because they hated them because they're jerks. I don't think that's really possible to replicate, but trying that at least somewhat makes sense. Arming up the Kurds and the Shiistan army and Iran-backed militias against them is insane. Obviously counterproductive on the very face of it. But anyway, so they'll continue on. And then McCain, of course, is quoted here saying we've got to put more people on the ground there. Michelle Flournoy, who lost the Afghan war, who said she didn't want Obama to ask her to be the new Secretary of Defense because she's waiting for Hillary. doesn't matter that she lost the Afghan war as Deputy Secretary of Defense for Policy and champion of the surge, Afghan surge and counterinsurgency strategy. Complete failure, the cost of tens of thousands of human lives. She says we need more. We have under-resourced the strategy. We need to provide more firepower support. ISIS is not a threat, is a threat not only to Iraq and Syria, it's a threat to us, she said. Again, Michelle Flournoy, who, I wonder if you go back, she was still there in the Defense Department in 2011, wasn't she? What was the Michelle Flournoy position on the war in Libya and Syria? Now coming to me crying about the Islamic State. And let's get this part straight. There is a threat that Islamic State loyal fighters could either from inside America who change their mind and join up, or who somehow infiltrate the United States of America, which is not completely impossible, could commit some terrorist attacks inside this country. But why? Only because they want to try to bait us into reinvading Iraq. War is the health of the Islamic State. That's the only possible reason that they would want to attack us, would be to get us to attack them back, to get us to replicate the exact same stupid mistake of listening to the Michelle Flournoys and sending in a surge of American troops to fight them on their territory. It's exactly what they want. It's the same Bin Ladenite strategy. And, you know, this guy Baghdadi and all his Ba'athist generals and the rest of these guys, they still claim Bin Laden. They say they don't like Zawahiri anymore because Zawahiri tried to boss him around from his basement. He's giving orders from hiding where he has no ability to enforce them whatsoever and got called out on his bluff and lost his presumed authority over these guys back in 2013. But they still claim Bin Laden and his goals, which include, of course, fighting the far enemy. Bleeding the American Empire to bankruptcy so that we can get the hell out of the way so that they can have their caliphate. That's the funny irony, too, here, is if it wasn't for all the Israeli traitors in Washington, D.C., keeping the policy oriented against the Shiites in Iran, Hezbollah, and Syria, then we would have a full-scale war against the Islamic State right now. And, wait, what was the ironic thing I was going to say? Damn. Reading this Wall Street Journal article in front of me, and it distracted me again. Let's see. If it wasn't for all the treachery, then we'd be fighting a full-scale war for the Islamic State, which would quite possibly, a full-scale American war could drive them from Mosul, could drive them from Fallujah, in which case America would just be proving Al-Qaeda right and the Islamic State wrong. That it's too early to declare a caliphate. For everyone who shares that goal, you've got to bleed the American Empire to bankruptcy first, and only then will you be able to succeed in your plan. So, I guess we can thank Israel's fifth column for keeping American foreign policy divided in half in such a nonsensical kind of a way that they can't follow through with anything. Because whatever it is that they do is horrible. At least they can only half-ass either part of it. Oh, I should have been paying attention to that. That's problematic. Oh, well. Take care of it tomorrow. Yeah, man. So there's that. They said they're going to shift the strategy. Maybe they're going to go back to trying to back the Sunnis. But, you know, in the surge in the whole awakening movement and arming up a separate Sunni force, back then, they really only helped to build the Islamic State and their arms. Not everything that they have come from sacking the Shia army forces. But it's a lot of that is the guns that Petraeus gave them back then, too. Now alliances have shifted again. And even if they could arm up the anti-ISIS Sunni militias, they don't have the ability at this point to drive the Islamic State out boy, they would need some shiny new leader on a white horse with a lot more charisma than Baghdadi or any of his guys to come in and rally all of Iraqi Sunnistan against the Islamic State now? I don't see it, man. Not that, again, I'm supporting sending in the Marines. I'm just saying the American, the policy and the strategy don't match. They ought to just call it quits, man. You know, if getting rid of Saddam got us Baghdadi, then what are we going to get when we get rid of him? Somebody younger and worse? As when the Israelis killed, what's his name, before Nasrallah, who is kind of a dipshit in a way or whatever, you know? Oops, I guess you're not supposed to say that, but... he got replaced by Nasrallah, who is considered to be the most capable leader in the Middle East, or Arab one anyway, the leader of Hezbollah there. And it's one that the Israelis, I think some of them have said on the record, their politicians and intelligence officials have said on the record, that's one assassination they wish they could have taken back. All right, but anyway... Oh, and there was one article. Did I mention this about how the Iraqi government is still paying salaries to all the Iraqi government employees in conquered Sunnistan, and the Islamic State's getting all the money, and it's hundreds of millions of dollars. And yet, if they cut it off, then the Islamic State gets to say to all those people, see, you're completely cut off. That was your last tie to Baghdad, even though you're not getting the money anyway. And now, you know, let, I guess send in Holbrook's ghost to take a black magic marker and make those soft borders hard now. There is no more Iraq. Even in my notes, I start off, you know, I'll have Iraq and Syria as like separate categories. Nah. In fact, I just saw Fox News. Am I on Fox or CNN today? No, I'm on CNN International. And they showed over the lady's shoulder a map of former Iraq, and they still had the old borders on the outside. But on the inside, it said Shiite state, Sunni territory, and Kurdistan. And, yeah, it's a fait accompli, man. I think they were trying to hold it together, but their policies were tearing it apart. So they did it. All right, now, here's a couple of things. I mentioned this article yesterday. I'm going to try to get this guy on the show. It's David Sirota, and besides mentioning, I want to actually interview him about it because I read it. It's really good stuff. And I like that it's not, you know, idiot Republican mudslinging or whatever. This guy's a legit journalist, and he's some kind of liberal progressive type. And I don't know if he has a grudge against Hillary or not, but... you know, certainly he's, I don't know, he's got a more reasonable take on it than, you know, she's a secret Muslim or some crap like some idiot right-winger would have written it up as, right? Although, you know, I don't know if he mentions Israel in here. Does he mention Israel in here? I don't think he does mention Israel in here. We're going to get to that. And then there's this other one. This one is at the Daily Caller, and I didn't have a chance to read this whole thing yet. I don't know if he calls Hillary a secret Muslim in here, but he accuses her of hooking up Boeing and General Electric for money. I love this scandal. It's huge. It's not going away. So many different special interests donated directly to Hillary Clinton's through her foundation or to her husband's inflated speaking fees. In such a way, like, this is just going to go on and on and on. It's so much fun. And it's the worst people in the world, right? The Saudi totalitarian police state, Boeing and General Electric from the military industrial complex and Wall Street bailout crew. And yeah, man. That Hillary Clinton. There ain't no bottom to her corruption, so we're going to have a lot of fun with this. And I think, isn't it fun how on the left liberal side, they got everybody lined up behind her as far as the special interests go? More or less, I guess, they got the rank and file all lined up. They don't seem to have anybody really to oppose her except, you know, crappy old Bernie Sanders. who's worthless, and people even lesser than him. I don't know. There doesn't seem to be any Obama on the horizon to challenge her in this primary in a way that can win loyalty away. But she's terrible, right? She's like Bob Dole in 1996. Like, oh man, there's no way that this old coot can win. She's just... what could she possibly do to make the half of America who don't like her at all start to? You know, when her negatives are, you gotta take your average Republican, and maybe their support is only half, but their negative isn't that high. Their negative is only 30-something or whatever, because people don't care about them that much, or maybe they don't know about them. But everybody knows about Hillary Clinton, and at least half of us have already decided that when she speaks, we cross our arms. At least. Extend our middle fingers, maybe. How's she ever going to overcome that when she's already such old news? When all she is the wife of some guy who was president anyway. Why in the hell does that mean she should get to be president? The only reason she was a senator was because she was the wife of a president. She had never even lived in New York in her life. And then she goes to sign up for the Armed Services Committee so she can have that credibility as a warmonger to protect her right flank from criticism. She can commit genocide just as good as you or you. Watch. And she supported every war from Kosovo on, too. And she's so entitled, you know? I think everybody ought to start calling her Your Majesty and Your Highness and stuff like that all the time to mock her. And then we still got a year and a half of her just flopping around like a dying fish. No help coming. Nothing can be done. No hairdo is going to change it. No new rhetoric about, oh, I just love you so much. That's why I want total power, so I can just, you know, do things for you. It's just not going to win people over, man. No way. And now, it's true that Jeb is dumber and more horrible than I had anticipated. But I still think he's the shoe-in for this thing. But then again, nah, he's completely corrupt, too, and just look at what an absolute total disaster his younger brother was as a president. So, I don't know. I think it's kind of fun to go back to, because people really liked Obama. I don't know if and I guess people really liked Palin. Nobody really liked, McCain. But there were, much less so now, but back then you had the entire American right-wing rank and file just loved that Palin lady. There was real support and whatever. They identified with her in such a powerful way or whatever. And I hate that people like in politicians. I much prefer to have a some kind of, what you call it, 2000 and the year 2000 kind of deal. Where it was Bush, Gore, and the only question was, which side do you hate more? Not which side do you like. So at least we got that going for us, you know? Yeah, crap, I screwed up. I'm over time, and I'll see y'all later. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, Al Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all. QR Silver Commodity Discs. The first ever QR code 1 ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send him a message at commoditydiscs.com or check him out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks.